Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I'm Jason Tonner, your host.
I'm Jim Seals.
And I'm still me, Adrian Smith.
And we have a special guest joining us for Space Force as the latest member of our command crew. Please welcome Dr. Chris McLaughlin. Welcome, sir.
Hi, I'm not actually a doctor. I'm just a humble professor.
Oh, professor then. Well, but you teach political science, and I have forgotten what state you are in, of all things.
I'm in Virginia.
I thought it was either Virginia or maybe South Carolina, but okay, Virginia.
Slightly less humidity here.
And you tell us about your first encounter with Star Trek. Like, how did you first find this idea?
Well, I was born February 27th, 1969.
Okay.
And the Cloud Minders was on the next night, and I'm pretty sure I was watching.
Okay. All right. So day two.
Yes. I don't remember a time in my life that Star Trek was not a part of it from the time that they had to extend our school hours because of a flood. And, you know, my speed at running home determined whether I got to watch 75% of an episode or half of an episode.
Yeah, right.
The most physically fit I ever was as a child.
Sure. Well,
and okay. Now I'm 52 and I own a geological tricorder prop. So I think it's only getting worse the older I get.
Well, we get a little bit of disposable income and we can indulge our nerd fantasies.
Indeed.
So we have worked our way through all of Star Trek Picard. We got big news this weekend. Jim's like, and Chris, I remember you asking for this too when this show is coming out. But we have big news that Star Trek Strange New Worlds, the further adventures of Christopher Pike, Spock, and Number One on the Enterprise before Kirk joins the crew.
Yeah, as a Miami Dolphins fan, I don't really get to claim much about predicting the future. But when I heard that they were building actual sets for the Enterprise, rather than just, you know, redressing like the Discovery Bridge or something that they would do if this was meant to be a temporary thing, I started thinking they're going to find a way to make this a show. Unless the fans burn poor Anson Mount alive in his home, that they reject him that badly, they will try to find a way to make this a show. And God bless Anson Mount. He's just fabulous in the role. And I'm so glad this is happening. And they're keeping my favorite thing about Discovery alive, this sort of playing around in the background of the pre-Kirk years. So, so happy and excited about this.
By the second season of Discovery, CBS had realized that if they don't have a Star Trek show on CBS All Access, everybody cancels their subscription. Jim's nodding. This is exactly
the day Discovery ended. I'm like, okay, that's $10 I can save.
Yeah, I did the exact same thing. And so now it's the all Star Trek channel all the time.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, which is good for our show. Aid, what do you think about Star Trek Strange New Worlds?
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Anson Mount, I first saw Anson Mount in Hell on Wheels, the Western show.
Yeah.
And he was brilliant in that. And then obviously they put him as Pike. It's like, okay, this guy's going to be fantastic as Pike. And he was fantastic as Pike. And he definitely brought the entire show together and just see more of Pike pre-Kirk. Again, there's all those little threads we've seen through previous Star Treks. Hopefully they can pull on those. They did quite well with Discovery. There's a lot of them still out there that can be moved around and manipulated. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be really good. Yeah.
But then after Picard ended, we started with the films and we've worked our way through the first three and we're now at Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. So Jim, start us off. Like what was Trek like at this point? We're coming off of Search for Spock. Successful? Is there any talk of a television show? Like, what?
Okay, so there was always talk of it. Like, when you start reading the production notes and whatnot, there was always sort of like tricklings of, well, maybe there can be another show. But at this point, Paramount's really focused on the movies because Search for Spock does do well because it's literally a second part of a cliffhanger, right?
Yeah.
It's a backdoor cliffhanger. Like, what happened to Spock?
Yeah.
Here you go. So it does successful. It winds up being like number one for several weeks and is a main hit in like drive through theaters.
Oh, nice.
Which is how apparently I saw it originally.
Oh, really?
I don't have any memory of it, but apparently I saw it in a drive through.
I will note, by the way, that if drive throughs come back in the age of COVID, I will be really happy. Like, I will happily noodle my car down to a drive through to watch the movie.
Yeah. Like, drive throughs are kind of great. So those talk of it, and immediately they're like, okay, we're going to do a sequel. We're going to rebuild the Klingon bridge because it was only built for, you know, it was only built for like one or two camera setups. So that's the reason why we get the remodel. Okay. So they can actually move the camera throughout the whole set, and yeah, they build, you know, they fill it out with more character. I kind of like the original Sourceforge Spock set. I like the fact that the captain sat above his minions.
Yeah,
I thought that was very anti-Star Trek, like it's anti-Federation.
Yeah,
in style. But that's sort of it's more of a conventional bridge.
It's funny enough, my classroom set up the same way.
Do you just sit over your kids?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you occasionally have to phasal someone if they don't do the job?
Yeah, after I make him carry me in a sedan chair.
You come along like that. So, yeah, production started. The big controversy with 4, like I told you about the big controversy with 2 and dealing with Roddenberry's trying to sabotage the production. The big thing with 4 is 4 goes into production with Nimoy, Nicholas Meyer, and a few other, and Hall Bennett working on their own script, and then 2 other writers are brought in from another producer. And they're giving, because of the way the SAG rules work, they're giving like screenwriting credits, and script writing credits, because they were hired in that way, even though they don't use any of those scripts.
Oh, interesting.
So there's these two like sort of competing scripts that are going around. The other big story with 4 is the Eddie Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Tell us the Eddie Murphy story. Abe, you've heard this, obviously.
I have heard this, yeah.
So Eddie Murphy does his stand-up Delirious.
Yes.
Which has a Star Trek skit in it. Very famous. Captain Kirk. You know, that's where he's thrusting. He's doing the pelvic thrust on stage to the beat of the fight music, right? And he winds up signing this deal with Paramount. And Paramount's like, well, we got him. He's a Star Trek fan.
Right.
Put him in the next Star Trek movie. That's crossover talent. That's going to make money.
See, you know what this always reminds me of is trying to put Richard Pryor into Superman 3.
It's exactly that same situation.
It's like, let's try to make the character more hip. Right.
Well, the thing is Eddie Murphy's people's like, yeah, I totally want to be a Vulcan.
A Vulcan?
Yeah, he wants to do something that's not like, you don't think Eddie Murphy is going to do that, right?
I see.
Eddie Murphy wants to do something that's not Eddie Murphy. He wants to do something that's Star Trek.
Yeah.
That's part of the conflict of originally one of the scripts, I don't know if it was by the Hall Bennett team or by the second producer's team, whose name is escaping me.
Neeson and Kirk's.
There you go. One of the scripts, like the Gillian Anderson role, is written for Eddie Murphy. But that role, like,
well, kind of
saving whales, they're saving a plant.
Yeah. Okay.
Like the whales was sort of like to make Shatner happy.
Oh, really?
Because Shatner was a big advocate for whales at this time in his career. Like he did like a one man play. Like the reason why they quote T.S. Eliot is like he did like a stand up T.S. Eliot to whale songs. Like that was to make Shatner happy.
Yeah, because apparently they were trying to decide, okay, what animal can it be that may disappear before the 2300s? It's like, oh, can it be elephants or whales? That's the one. We'll have whales, yeah.
Yeah.
So. And for what it's worth, Nimoy says the whales were his idea.
Mm. As in all things, Shatner does take credit for it.
I'm shocked, completely shocked.
Right. Well, originally, the plan was going to be like, there was no probe. But Ulf was going to, like, people were going to be dying of a disease.
Oh.
And there was an ancient plant that was destroyed in the 20th century in the Amazon.
Oh. So it was more of a, it was more of a save the planet in the sense of nature than an animal species.
Yeah, it was going to be like, we have to go back in time to save the last plant of this very small thing. Because the idea was it was going to be a small thing that winds up saving all of humanity, like sort of like the hobbits in Lord of the Rings. Like the,
right.
The little people that you overlook, right?
Mike Lafferty is tuned in. Hey, Mike. Please carry on.
So that was going to be the conceit of it, was it was going to be a little thing that winds up getting rewritten. Obviously, we go with the whales. Because, you know, at this time, whaling was such a big thing in the political zeitgeist. Like, you have people in boats charging Russian whaling ships.
You know, it seems to me like these two different competing arguments, that it was Nimoy's idea, but it was put in to please Shatner. Those seem compatible to me. Like, it was Nimoy's idea to put it in to please Shatner, you know? Like,
those two. Well, no, I mean, according to Mark Altman's uncensored history of it, Nimoy is in there specifically quoted as Harv Benn and I came up with a time travel story, and then whales came to us fairly quickly. There's no mention of the Shat anywhere in Nimoy's version of how the story came about.
Interesting.
Yeah. So those so essentially Eddie Murphy. Let's get back to Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
So Eddie Murphy wants to be in the movie. The producers want to have Eddie Murphy in the movie because they're thinking they can make this a wild comedy, not just like a Star Trek comedy, but like a mainstream comedy. Like they're seeing dollar signs. The breakdown happens because the final script goes to Murphy, and he's like, no, I want to be a Klingon. I want to have makeup. I want to do a bulk. Like, I want to do something else. I don't want to be me.
Yeah.
So Paramount sort of has to, like, Michael Eisner has to sort of, like, sit there and go, like, well, we have this Star Trek property, and that makes X amount of dollars. And we have Eddie Murphy, and he makes X amount of dollars. Maybe we don't add them. Maybe instead we create another vehicle. And that's where the Golden Child enters production.
I actually liked – I remember that movie, and although I've only seen it once, I liked it. I remember liking it.
So that's sort of like the consolation prize. That's his – I was almost in a Star Trek movie. I'm going to headline a movie by myself.
You know, I think it's testament to Star Trek that when somebody wants to be in a Star Trek movie, they want to do Star Trek. Like, they want – you know, like this example of Eddie Murphy saying, I don't want to do my comedy routine. I want to play the game, you know, like I want to immerse myself in that world. It's because Star Trek has become such a huge phenomenon that it is.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg is definitely not playing Sister Act, is she? I mean, there's nothing like it at all. So
that's a great example. Yes, exactly. I was trying to think of the example in Star Trek VI when we get a cameo by somebody on Sulu's ship who's I can't even
Christian Slater.
Christian Slater, yes, exactly.
And like, good omen.
Yeah, he's just there to be Christian Slater in a Star Trek uniform, you know? But he's obviously a fan, and he wants to be a part of it, so we give him a spot, you know?
You know, best celebrity Star Trek cameo ever?
Is?
Fred the Hammer Williamson in the Cloudminders, because according to Fred, he was while he was doing consulting work for like people that wanted to have football sequences in their movie, and he just happened to be on the Paramount lot hanging out in the commissary, and he knew some of the Trek crew, and he said somebody came up to him and said, "Hey, how'd you like to come over the set and kick Shatner's ass?" And apparently, he was in costume like an hour later.
That's great. So you mentioned the plot, like. The probe. Now, quite frankly, this bizarre probe that comes from outside the galaxy broadcasts a signal that makes everything fall apart or shut down, and nobody can understand it because everybody who would understand it is dead. That sounds really familiar, right? Like, this is the plot from the motion picture.
Exactly.
Yeah. But instead of all the sexy times that is in the subtext for the motion picture, we have the whale stuff instead.
We get vaudeville. It's a vaudeville movie.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah.
Like, it's a comedy.
Well, so maybe we should talk about that. Like, I've been watching all these films as we've been going through, and I know we've all seen them a million times before, but I always remembered this film as being a comedy, but there are parts of it that are, like, upfront comedy. Like, when they're rescuing Chekhov in the hospital, they're playing like this sort of Keystone Cops music number. It's hard to really take any of this as very serious, as the stakes being very high when it's all sort of intentionally played for positive and laughs. Is this the first real comedy Star Trek, and does it work?
Piece of the action.
Okay.
And that's your first Trouble comedy Star Trek. Also?
Say again?
Trouble with Tribbles also?
Sure, yes. Okay.
Yeah, like, we've had comedy Star Trek. Like, that's okay. Not on hold up. This is the only time it's done in a movie.
Okay.
Like, this is, like, you can say that Final Frontier tries to be a comedy at times, and whether or not the joke play is up to personal taste. This is like the only time that I think the writers really set out to do a Star Trek comedy. Well, there is no real heavy. Yeah, we have the probe. We have the reason why we have to adventure, but the probe isn't personified in any way. It's not Wilson. It doesn't take the face of someone that we knew for 5 minutes before that she was abducted from the bridge.
Well, the argument of not having a villain and it being a comedy are different. I mean, what we learned from Galaxy Quest is you can have a comedy and still have a villain, right? But this show does both of those things. It is a comedy, but then it also has no villain. But the no villain works. I don't miss having a bad guy in this show, like I did in motion picture. Maybe that's just me.
I don't know who would you make the villain. Like, would you make the punk rocker guy and the bus the villain? would you know James Thatcher become the villain? I don't know. I just think the movie works so well in terms of just delivering. Like, yes, it is a message movie. Mm-hmm. It is one of the few Star Trek films that is point blank. It's all prerogative. It's human beings living on this planet, not to moral things to the point of extinction.
Right.
It's a very simple message, but it's in there. And they'll just try and deliver it in the most entertaining way possible, like the Keystone Cop music, the woman shouting, you know, doctor gave me a pill and I grew a new kidney.
Yeah.
Like all these little touches, the Spock Kirk argument, yes, no, yes, no, yes, you love Italian.
Right.
Like, yeah. Just all those little exchanges. It's just there to amp up their comedic moments, because this is the one time that everyone on the bridge crew is a fish out of water. Like, normally that's Spock.
Yeah.
And now everyone is in that boat with Spock.
Right.
And Spock's even more alien because he hasn't quite come back from the dead yet.
Yeah, yeah.
I also think, unless I'm mistaken, there is no body count for the actual probe as well. Whereas with the motion picture, it's like it comes and destroys the Klingon vessel, then it comes and destroys the space bay. This is like it shuts all the electricity down and communications down, but there's no actual shows of like spaceships exploding or people dying or something. There's storms, there's exploding windows, that's it.
There's this moment we see a starship, I think it's the Yorktown, and the captain is saying, we're running out of power, life support is failing, the engineer is rigging up a solar sail. We're hopeful that it will supply enough power to keep us alive.
Yeah.
And that becomes the excuse. Like, nobody died in this movie. They all, their Starfleet engineers all came up with some way to keep everybody from not dying long enough for Kirk and the rest of the crew to save the Earth. Save the whales to save the Earth.
You put everybody in the transporter buffer and keep them alive for 80 years. Everybody knows it.
You're skipping ahead.
I was waiting for beam them to the other side of the galaxy because Scotty knows how to do that.
Oh, don't bring up that awful movie in this good times we're having, Chris. That's a party foul.
Sorry.
foul.
Yeah, Chris.
Well, Jason, I hope I don't wreck the format of your podcast, but I actually, when I read your question about the nature of a villain and all this, I actually have a fairly big thought about that, which kind of ties a few things together and how I feel about this film.
Yeah.
Because when I rewatched it, it kind of confirmed this feeling I've had that Star Trek IV, in many ways, is kind of a changing of the guard for the franchise.
Tell me what you mean by that. I saw this in the notes and I was curious. So yeah, in what sense is this film a changing of the guard?
Well, okay. To one extent or another, Gene Roddenberry is in charge from the moment that it comes out of his typewriter up through Star Trek One. Now there were, you know, there was the Philip Kaufman motion picture they were going to do with Toshiro Mifune, and but it's more, and you know, of course, you know, Roddenberry always had to answer to the network and the studio, but more or less it kind of begins with Roddenberry.
Right.
And so you get to see all of Gene's virtues and vices in this franchise for decades.
Yeah.
And one of the things about Gene that you see in the franchise up until then is Gene's atheism.
Sure.
Gene was a militant atheist.
Okay.
And it informs his work so much that for years, Harlan Ellison used to mock Gene as a hack with one plot: God is a malfunctioning computer.
Okay.
So we get to Star Trek IV, and by this point, it's very, 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 very clear that the proudly Jewish Leonard Nimoy is now in charge.
Exactly.
Because our antagonist, this probe, is unique in all of the things that we encounter in classic Star Trek, because it's the only alien thing we learn nothing about. Okay. It is completely unknowable and above us.
Okay.
And the only way that makes a lick of sense is if you interpret that as the Old Testament God.
Interesting. Okay.
That is Old Testament judgment being visited upon a wicked planet. Okay. And, you know, I mean, that probe is getting ready to do a Noah on us, basically.
Probe is Yahweh.
Yes.
When I was looking at it, I remember noticing as I was watching the film again, and this doesn't really become clear until near the end, when it physically moves itself into a position parallel to that of the whales.
Yes.
Like the whales tip tail up as they start to sing, and the probe turns its back up to answer them. And that's when I'm like, oh, duh. Like the thing on the top of it is like a water spout, right? Like as it floats away, we actually see the outside skin of the probe better than we've ever seen it before. And its outside skin looks like the skin of a whale.
Mm-hmm.
So,
because we all see God in our own image.
All right. So this is the God of the whales. It's the Yahweh of the whales, huh?
Or maybe we're seeing Yahweh as the whales see it.
There you go. Yeah.
I kind of like that.
And the ironic thing is, while Nimoy is making this explicitly religious Jewish film, I would argue, Roddenberry is bitter on the other side of the town, trying to get Paramount to ignore 2, 3, and 4 and film his notorious film script, The God Thing, where God is a malfunctioning computer.
Yeah, we hit God Thing when we were talking about the motion picture, and we kind of walked through some of that stuff, and that was a hell of a script, The God Thing.
Yeah, I mean it's like Gene was working overtime to prove Harlan Ellison right.
Right. So
I mean, much as I would like to have seen Kirk punching Jesus on the, and I say that as a good Anglican Catholic, Kirk punching Jesus on the bridge of the Enterprise, it's like Roddenberry was so invested in becoming the cliche becoming the stereotype that the people had about him.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, to me, thinking of the film that way becomes much more interesting about who the antagonist really is. Who the protagonist really is. I mean, if depending on how one bends the rules of literature, and here's where I would definitely defer to you. if the probe is God, who are the real villains here? Right. And it certainly ties in nicely also for the environmental thing, to think of man as the real antagonist of the film.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I certainly agree with you that, go ahead, Jim, you had a comment.
I don't think it's so much I don't think it's so much man, because man is ultimately the people. Like, I really enjoy this interpretation of
thank you
as Yahweh. Like, I think that's just, that is a level of insight that I had never put into this movie, and I'm actually really liking it, because it literally shows you the probe parting the sea. Like, there was that moment when we go right through San Francisco and we see the waters literally rising up to the the cloud, and now you can read it as like a Red Sea metaphor. I don't think it's necessarily man, but I think it's modern man, right?
Okay.
The potential of what we can be, because that is ultimately the crew and our heroes, and they save us from our own mistake in the movie. I think it's more the systems that, you know, 20th century 1980s humanity. Yeah. Like, I think it's mostly them as the villain, as opposed to just like it's not, what is that, In Ocello, where Dr. Man was the bad guy? Yeah. Like, I don't think it's that on the nose. I think it's more nuanced than that.
The most gruesome, horrifying part of this movie is the clip footage of Whalen. Right? When the people are, the crew are on the tour, Kirk and Spock are on the tour of the Cetacean Institute, and Gillian stops in front of a television, and we watch a bunch of senior citizens and a nun, for Christ's sakes. There's a nun in that shot who's right up front. Like, why would you do that, right? And they're watching this television as we see footage of whalers peeling dead whale corpses, right? And it's awful. Like, it's grotesque. And of course, at the end, I mean, ultimately, the threat is absolutely the whaling ship. Like, that's the closest this movie ever gets to firing a shot, is when the harpoon bounces off the hull of the Klingon warbird, right? The Klingon bird of prey. So yeah,
they're trying to pierce the side of an innocent with a spear. Maybe it's he's a Christian too.
Now we've got, I was going to describe us as Jim was describing modern man as the bad guy. I was going to say, well, we live in a fallen world. And then I started to catch myself. Are we talking the Jewish version or the Christian version or like what? Yeah.
Well, it could be like the Superman movies where we just blend all of those texts in one pamphlet.
As, quote, as I have written elsewhere. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Abe, what do you think about the whale is God, probe is God motif?
Okay. I like spaceships. There you go. This is too deep for me. Crikey. I just remember this is the one with the whales and San Francisco. It's like, crikey. But yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Now you're kind of filling it in. Obviously, this is probably the first time I've seen this in absolutely ages. So
yeah.
This would have gone completely over my head. But now you're kind of seeing, you know, the idea of, you know, modern man versus future man. And yeah, it makes sense. There is a lot to it. But yeah, it's... This one film always bugged me because this was always the movie where it was like, oh, Star Trek. Okay, what are we going to get? Oh, they walk around town for 2 hours. Okay.
Yeah.
That always annoyed me. And watching it again, it's not quite as bad as it's not as bad. It's not as annoying to me now as it was because all the characters get to do something. They also, you get to see a lot of stuff going on. Sulu gets to fly his helicopter. Chekhov gets the best line in the episode, in the actual show. So, so it's good. And again, you even get stuff with obviously Spock's arc again. He comes out of himself and, you know, slowly changes and manipulates himself from the how do you feel business and all that stuff. So. Yeah. There's a lot going on. So, but yeah, this one was always the one. It's like, okay, where are the aliens? Where's the monsters? It's like, no, we're just going to walk around San Francisco and see whales.
Now, Abe, you've touched on a bunch of things there that I want to get to. I want to start with the fact that they're walking around San Francisco all movie, because it struck me as, quite frankly, a budget saving measure. Like this, there is not a lot of money blown on this movie, or at least it seems to me. What was this a low budget? Was this Star Trek on the cheap? And I remember talking about the budget for Star Trek III as well. Like, budget was a big issue for these movies. When does that stop being true? When does Star Trek stop trying to become done on the cheap and become, we're going to throw as much money as we can at this to make a big blockbuster?
I'm going to save you time on that question. It's really Star Trek Discovery when it's like $1.5 million an episode.
Well, before that, though, was the J.J. Abrams movie.
Yeah, I'm being sarcastic. Like, all these films are done with a budget conscious mindset. Like, we think we watch the movie and we're like, oh, they just filmed in San Francisco. Yeah, that's not cheap. You're filming in one of the biggest port cities on the West Coast.
Yeah.
You have to get licensing. You have to close down sections of the town.
Right.
Like, the reason why the goal from Alameda is there is because they had to block off whole streets. And her car wasn't able to be moved. And so they just signed her up to be an extra as Mia Copa. And she then says that line of, oh, I don't know, maybe it's across the bay in Alameda. She says that line, it's an ad lib. She was not given permission to do that. So they immediately have to sign her to a SAG contract.
Who is that woman?
Just someone who was living on the street. She was living in the apartment complex that they're filming in front of, that they bought time off of, but her car is parked there, so she can't move her car. Okay. So they have to do this whole thing just for this ad-lib line. Like, filming in San Francisco is never cheap.
I guess if they'd filmed it on a sound stage, that would have been cheap.
That would, like, Star Trek 3 is much cheaper than Star Trek 4.
Because this is what they were saying. Apparently, they were saying that the director had previously done another film that was set in San Francisco.
So they'd
seen all these kind of, when they went to do all the recce and stuff, they'd seen all these places. Oh, we need to do that. We need to do that. And so they tried to get as much of this in as possible. I mean,
let's get it, and it
feels like San Francisco. This does not feel like generic American city to me. I can tell it's San Francisco, not New York. You know, yeah. So there is, they've definitely put the effort into it. And it isn't until, again, knowing that Starfleet Academy is in San Francisco now. When I originally saw the film, I had no clue that at all. I just remember there being a big red bridge. That's it. So they at least there's a reason for it, just rather than just going, where's the cheapest thing we can film? Well, we'll go over there. That'd be fine. So
now, Chris, you've mentioned this before, this idea that this film set in San Francisco has some connections to another film also about time travel, also set in San Francisco.
Yes. Well, one of my absolute favorite people ever connected to the Star Trek franchise is Nicholas Meyer, who directed 2 and 6 and to varying degrees wrote all the even number ones. Coincidentally, the good ones. I wonder that more people at Paramount didn't see that connection. And I'm happy that he's back working on Discovery now.
Yeah.
Nicholas Meyer is also near and dear to my heart to his 79 time travel movie, Time After Time, where H.G. Wells is actually invents a time machine. But unfortunately for him, unbeknownst to him, one of his good friends is Malcolm McDowell and is also David Warner. And is also Jack the Ripper. He absconds with the time machine and makes it to 1970s San Francisco. And then Wells, being a good, upstanding Victorian gentleman, has to go and follow him. And it's this Victorian Wells trying to survive in 70s San Francisco and also stop Jack the Ripper.
And fall in love with Mary Steenburgen.
Well, isn't that a given?
It's a given. Yes. It's a given.
Wouldn't we all?
What is the connection between that film and this film? Was there actually influence from that movie on this?
Well, it depends on which interview you read.
Okay.
But when Meyer was brought on to 4 surprisingly late in the process and originally turned it down because he said, I've already done my time traveler come to San Francisco movie and like actually lobbied to have the whole thing move to Paris for a while. Okay. But I assume, you know, they put enough zeros on the end of the check or they made enough concessions to where it becomes one of the more oddly conceived screenplays ever, because basically all the beginning stuff and all the end stuff is Harv Bennett and all the people working for him, and the whole middle part is Nicholas Meyer. You know, I mean, and it connects fairly seamlessly. You don't get this great sense that there are two different bits of writers working on this. And depending on the interview that you read, Meyer says basically the middle of the movie I have read one interview where he refers to it as all the deleted scenes from Time After Time.
Okay. The framing sequence with the president of the Federation and
Keenan Wynn.
And the Klingon And then following it with a Klingon ambassador, like, I want to know that he totally sells that speech. He comes in and gives his version of what happened in Star Trek 2 and 3. And by the time he's done, I want to arrest Kirk for treason. Like, he's passionate about it. He's like, we must have justice, you know? And he's only like the second Klingon we've really seen with a major role since, you know, we had Krug and we had this guy. And he's such a great counterpoint to Krug because he's well-spoken and he's charismatic, you know, and he's passionate.
He falls into more of a next generation kind of that honorific kind of title, doesn't he, really? More than anything, the whole the arbiter thing that all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, like we were saying about that with the other Klingon, that's exactly the same thing. We finally see this death before dishonor kind of stuff going on, and he feels the official part of the Klingon's homeworld stuff. So.
That framing sequence is what really makes us feel like the third part of a trilogy. I mean, the mission to like save the Earth by saving whales has got nothing to do with Khan or the Genesis planet or any of the things that have been part of this trilogy of movies. Jim's got a point, but the framing sequence makes it fit more than I thought it. When I first thought of the movie, before I had rewatched it, I thought this movie's kind of the odd man out. It doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the plot. But when I watched it again just last night, the framing sequence gave it a home. It felt like it fit. Jim?
Well, I think like the through line of these three movies, of this trilogy,
okay,
the through line is Kirk and Spock.
Okay.
Like if you put all the other toys aside and you just focus on the Kirk and Spock relationship and the dynamic and how that plays and what Kirk is willing to give up to get Spock back.
Yeah.
And then what Kirk is willing, and then them trying to reconnect the whole movie.
Yeah.
The whole movie is them trying to emotionally reconnect.
Right. No, I agree.
Jim, you used to call me Jim. Like So if you focus on that aspect of these three films, it works almost seamlessly.
I see.
Now, I love the Klingon ambassador.
Yeah.
There will be no peace as long as Kirk lives. Like I've memorized his whole speech. Like he's like one of my favorite people in a bit part in any movie. Like the Klingon ambassador for me is just top notch scenery chewing. He doesn't overstay his welcome. He's even going to come back in Star Trek VI.
That's right.
Briefly.
Yeah.
He has a great look to him. Like he just looks like it in my head. Like those two Klingons, those Wolf, and then those this guy.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. It's just like in just sort of like how I perceive the race as Klingons. Like those are the two people I go to in terms of you're either loud and bombastic or you're trying to adhere to this honor chivalry code that no one else in your race is actually buying into. They play a lot of lip service too.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about the Klingon ambassador is I haven't actually read Meeson and Kirk's draft, but I read an interview with the two of them describing it.
Yeah.
And their draft ends with more of a courtroom drama.
Yeah.
You know, your dramatic payoff is where they, you know, one by one, they get exonerated of the charges.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, well, I wonder if the Klingon ambassador, since he's kind of the prosecuting attorney in the opening frame sequence, were we going to see more of him in the Meeson and Kirk's draft?
Yes.
Since it was going to be more of a courtroom thing.
I would have loved that ending. I would have loved to have that character come back at the end, because he is sort of set up as an antagonist at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He vanishes for the second half, and if you're going to do a framing sequence, it should have this. It should be parallel. Like as a screenwriter, putting that character in the beginning of the frame, he should be at the end. His absence is a real flaw in the ending sequence.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting reading Nicholas Meyer's most recent interview about this, because he says that the film has any flaw, it's the fact that it has five different endings. It just keeps ending and ending and ending and ending. And to me, you know, wanting to see this Meeson and Kirk's draft, the fact that theirs ends with the courtroom exoneration and then you go home. You know, it's hard to argue with the movie that we got, but it is interesting to see what a remix would have been like.
Yeah, interesting. All right,
Like hearkening back to the five different endings, it's not as egregious as say Return of the King.
Oh God!
None of those endings like all those endings together, maybe 8 minutes of the movie, but they're all emotional endings.
Yeah,
Kirk and Spock walking towards camera after Spock talks to Sarek is an ending of the trilogy, really.
Yeah,
it's you know them reconciling their relationship. They're on the same page. They're walking in step together towards the camera, towards adventure. But then, if we didn't have the Enterprise at the end,
and we have the Enterprise,
that makes me smile. And like that moment when all of the bridge crew are in that shuttle pod and they're bickering, and it's just like Sulu wants the Excelsior, and Scotty's like, "Why do you want that?" But like that moment, and then you hit the music string and you see the Enterprise A.
Yeah.
Like for me, that's the come home. Like, that's the finale I want.
Yeah.
Because that means I'm going to get more Star Trek adventures in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And this is the first A ship, isn't it? We've not seen anything previously.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Abe, one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking earlier is that you felt like everybody kind of got their moment in this show. And that's true. They do. But there's a famous apocryphal story about Sulu meeting his grandfather or great-grandfather on the streets of San Francisco. And I think, Chris, you wrote about this.
Yeah, I've actually heard George Takei talk about this. I don't know if it's apocryphal, and you know his story is pretty detailed. I'm inclined to think that it actually happened.
Yeah, you're right. I misspoke. I should not say apocryphal. I just meant that it's a famous story. A lot, but go on. Tell us what you know.
Well, everybody was supposed to get their big moment in this film. You know, Chekhov had his nuclear vessels, and you know, Scotty had the computer, and it was noticeable even at the time that Sulu doesn't really get anything except for you know flying the helicopter scene.
Yeah.
Well, the reason that he got short shrift is because there was scripted a scene where while they're wandering the streets of San Francisco, Sulu was going to have this emotional scene with this little kid who he later realizes is his grandfather.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, George, you know, the thrill of getting something to do other than, you know, arm photon torpedoes, you know, what a great delight for any actor, you know, to be called on to do something. But apparently the way that it was blocked, it was set for, you know, last thing of the day. And the kid, the kid actor, it was freaking terrible. It's just, he was crying and was just, you know, inconsolable. And it just got to be really, 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 you know, unusable and unfilmable. And eventually, you know, time ran out in the day and the studio just said, you know, this is our last day in San Francisco. We don't want to pay child actor rates for another day. So scene just got cut.
Well, one of our recurring themes in this show has been George Takei getting shafted. I'm still hung up on the Captain Sulu on the Excelsior with First Officer Savick and Dr. Marcus that could have been but never was. And
well, this, you know, they did the letter challenge. They gave him his chance.
Yeah.
So it's surprising how much you don't realize that that's actually a thing that goes through all of these films until you watch them all in succession.
Yeah,
it's quite surprising. It's like Sulu's almost like dying for a ship from fighting Star Trek 2. It's like, okay, where did that come from? Yeah, now you see it. So,
Jim, what do you think? Sulu gets shafted?
Well, he doesn't. He gets the ship at the end, doesn't he? I mean, yeah, come on, he doesn't not get the Excelsior. So he gets it.
Yeah, like Sulu gets the best payoff, right? Like, gets the best payoff of any of the supporting cast in these movies.
Right.
Yes, he gets short shafted. Yes, the only thing he really does in this movie is fly the helicopter and watch, you know, the windshield wipers go backwards and forwards.
Yeah, exactly.
And wear a cape. He does get the cape. Come on.
That's true. That's a sweet cape.
He had the cape in 3 when he got to say, "Don't call me tiny," right?
Like, yeah.
Squishy cape in 3.
Yeah. But he gets, like, the fact that he opens Star Trek 6.
Yeah.
He opens it.
Yeah.
Shatner doesn't. Nimoy doesn't. Yeah. It's George Takei on the bridge of the Excelsior.
Yeah.
And the other nice thing is that he's not mild in all of the racism that the rest of the crew is mild in for that film.
For the guess who's coming to dinner bit.
Yes. Like all those lines. Like, George Takei doesn't have to say any of them.
Well, so save that.
I have a bone to pick with Star Trek 6. Like, I have my axe. I'm going to take it out. George Takei didn't have to deal with any of that in the movies. Like, yes, it's sad that he doesn't get this scene. But if the whole scene was supposed to be this scene with a child actor and the child actor is not performing, because I've also read about it, and apparently in practice, but you know, he was great. That's why they hired him. But once they got the cameras on him and they got him in the makeup and in all the clothes and whatnot, it just fell apart for the kid. Like, I can't beat up a kid. Like, I'm not going to beat up a little kid.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So be like, ah, oh, they should have got a, you know, they should have got another.
They should have gone another day, right? Yeah. Yeah. So this film does continue another tradition of the Star Trek films, which is introducing an actress that most of us have never seen before with this film. We have the character of Gillian, originally written for Eddie Murphy, but obviously changed a lot. Because I don't think that Eddie Murphy would have been, you know, kissing Kirk on the cheek, or he would have been quite so handsy with her as he is in the movie.
It was originally going to be two characters.
Hold on. Jim?
At one point, like, the character was supposed to be a professor. Like, it was going to be a different role. Like, it's just, I'm just saying it as the equivalent. Like, it's not a one-to-one equivalency. It's more of a, this is the modern person that's going to interact with the crew and give the crew the story beats that they need to succeed.
Chris?
Yeah, well, she's the Gillian we get on screen is actually a composite of two characters from the Meeson Kirk's draft. Eddie Murphy was going to be this slightly goofy English professor who was completely obsessed with the notion that UFOs were real. And the original character named Gillian was going to be his buddy who works in TV. And there was going to be this running gag that, whenever Eddie Murphy, due to his interaction with the Enterprise crew, got some tangible proof that, yes, there are aliens and whatnot, he would try to show it to Gillian. And for some reason or another, he would not get to see it. They describe in particular this one scene where Eddie Murphy would get his hands on a phaser. But before he could actually show it to Gillian, his cat got a hold of it. And while he's trying to tell her about this cool thing he found, the cat is disintegrating bits of furniture around the room.
Wow. Okay.
And so when Eddie Murphy dropped out, they basically just synthesized those two characters together.
I see. But Gillian, so what do we think of Gillian? I mean, when I was watching the film, I was struck by the fact that she's like the one. The obvious thing for her to do is to be a sort of romantic interest for Kirk. Kirk's twice her age at this point. I'm not sure that it would have been convincing, but what's great about it is they don't force it. And I feel like the actress does a pretty good job of like sort of deflecting this older guy who keeps trying to grab her arm all the time. And I was really surprised by how many times Kirk just reaches out and grabs her in this movie. but maybe that's just me. But he seems to think that he's got a shot with her at the end of this movie, and she's like, I'll call you, and leaves him, you know? And I know that in later comics, I know I've read at least one comic where they hint that the two of them have a relationship, but the film doesn't pursue that at all.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that.
Yeah.
The DC, and I cannot for the life of me remember what it's called, because I'm looking at my bookshelf now to find it.
It's the one that Adam Hughes does.
Yes, exactly. As I was saying, it's the Adam Hughes artwork, and it's brilliant.
It's a wonderful Romulan plotline.
Exactly. Yeah, and source of separation for the first time.
Kirk actually falls in love with a young Romulan woman when he's a lieutenant, and she continues to show up throughout the various eras of the show, and we find out that she's got a daughter whose name is like Kurak or something, and it's obviously Kirk's daughter. And there's one shot, there's a couple of pages in which Gillian is there with Kirk on her boat, apparently. But none of that's in the movie.
The book is called Debt of Honor. And it's written by Chris Claremont.
Thank you.
Yeah. Because there's a bit where, I know exactly what you're talking about. There's a bit where Adam Hughes draws Kirk in like this swimsuit.
Yeah.
And it's like spelt Kirk. Like it's Kirk from like season, maybe day one without catering.
Yeah.
Season one. And he's complaining about having to be forced to kiss a whore at some point and then, like, trying to walk that back.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the book, but I've read a lot, and that scene always sort of pops up as the weird moment in the book.
Yeah, Debt of Honor is a great old comic. But anyway, Jillian, what do you think?
Well, this may just be my personal biases show, sure. But to me, the fundamental problem is that, okay, six of one, half a dozen of another. You can break these percentages down however you want.
Sure.
She's not good. And, you know, the fact, I hate to dump it all on Catherine Hicks, but, well, you sort of can't help but notice that she's done precisely nothing else of note, unless you're so deep in the 80s you remember stuff like Space Camp. So I don't think she's that good of an actress. I mean, again, maybe she got badly directed. Maybe the script doesn't do her any favors. But just, she seems like she's in a different movie than everybody else. I mean, she's, I can't help but wonder if, like, they didn't pick up pretty quickly on the fact that there's, like, zero chemistry between between her and Kirk. Now, Shatner gonna Shatner. You know, he's doing his usual stuff, but just, you know, I mean, she's just kind of there advancing the plot along. She's like a forerunner of a cutscene. Like, yeah, okay, let's just get through this so we can get back to the part of the game I actually care about.
I found her more
I think she kind of sucks, and the part of the reason they and the way that it's cut, they spend as little time on her as possible. Mm-hmm. And I tell you honestly, but I will give some credit. The reason why I think that nobody really quite got this character is, I was reading an interview with Catherine Hicks herself, and she said, like, her favorite part of the movie is when she jumps in Kirk's arms, and you know, with the exact line is like, "I don't have anybody else here." You know, that she and honestly, I didn't think about this until I read her interview. Like how really sad that is.
Yes.
You know, it just seems like nobody but Catherine Hicks, so I guess I owe an apology now, picks up on, you know, that's a very poignant line. You could have done a little more than that, than, oh, she's in the future now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just my take.
Yep.
Well, to Catherine Hicks's defense, she does go off to play on Seventh Heaven with Stephen Collins from the motion picture. That goes on for like 11 seasons.
11 seasons on Seventh Heaven. Okay.
Yeah, like, she does do something of note. It's just, it may not be within the sphere that we normally associate entertainment with, because it is a Christian program.
Yeah.
But it was huge. Like, speaking for someone who grew up in a Christian household,
right,
Seventh Heaven was a huge deal.
Interesting.
I salute her for becoming the female Kirk Cameron.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. I'll admit to that. The thing is like, so this is going to be a discussion point for False Contact too. So in False Contact, one of the points that they were discussing is Lily going to come with Picard to the future?
Yeah.
Like, right. Are we going to do that beat that we did in Starfleet Hall? The difference, I think, is like, Jillian justifies her existence because she's the only one with firsthand experience to tending to the whale.
Yeah, when she says, "I'm a marine biologist," how many people in the future know anything about whales?
Yeah,
that is a good point. That's not just Kirk trying to be nice to her. That really is a good point.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, that's a great moment of like, look, you've killed off this whole race. The one thing I'm passionate about are whales.
Yeah,
like, the only person who can take care of the whales is going to be me.
But you're suggesting that maybe that doesn't hold up.
That doesn't hold up with Lily. Like, she doesn't have a reason to be in the future.
Right.
Outside of, hey, I want to get out of the awful present.
Yeah.
And I don't think Star Trek wants to propagate that message, because we, even though we are escaping to the future by watching this show, I don't think necessarily they want to say, hey, it's okay to just jump out of time because your present sucks.
And Chris, I agree. That very quick line that she says, like, I don't have anybody here. That she's got no friends. No, she just slapped her only friend, right? She just called him a son of a bitch. And no family, no nothing here. Like, I wish I had a little bit more interiority on that character. I wish I knew.
Yeah, you know, if we had gotten one more scene, because it's hard for me to imagine that in an era where they've cracked the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that there's some mystical whale knowledge that this 20th century woman from a time where they're sewing people up like catgut, you know, is really that necessary. But I think when she actually says, "I don't have anybody," I think you get the real reason she wants to come to the future. And I think showing a little more of that inner sadness might have given her a little more raison d'etre to be in the film. Otherwise, it's just like a wah, wah moment that you don't need.
You know, a 3-minute scene of her in her apartment.
Yes.
Could have sold that character.
It doesn't even have to be 3 minutes.
Throw in the bit with the cat phasering the furniture if you want. But, you know, just, you know, give us something.
Could have been 3 seconds.
It could just be like 45 seconds. It doesn't even have to be 3 minutes. Like, she goes into the apartment, there's no lights on.
Yeah.
She makes a line like they did that in Batman Returns with Catwoman, right?
Yeah.
I was in her apartment for 45 seconds. She makes a comment about to her boyfriend that doesn't exist, and then you know exactly that character's interior, you know, portrait.
Yeah.
And another thing, another thing about this is again watching this recently again.
Yes.
The idea that she's the only person that knows stuff about whales, as Chris has alluded to.
Yeah.
There's got to be whale knowledge out there. For starters, Kirk recognizes their whales as they're going through the database on the Klingon vessel.
Right.
So they eventually get to, like, oh, humpback whales. Oh, yeah, da, da, da. And people are quoting Moby Dick all over the place in other episodes. So whales are not like this lost mystical thing. Oh, what are whales? I've never heard of them. What are they? They know they're there. So the idea there's not some tucked away knowledge in this Federation database that says, whales, yes, they did this,
okay. Hey, guys, I appreciate all that, but let's be honest. In terms of Hollywood explainers saying, I'm a marine biologist, I've studied whales, that's a pretty good excuse to time travel. Like, I realize that it's Starfleet, and they're probably pretty smart.
It is, but I think the idea that she's going there because she's got no one else, again, I think that would kind of give it a slightly downer, right? Kind of like, I could kind of see. And that's probably why they didn't use it.
Okay.
But I think, they know stuff. Come on.
It's not so much, like, I can read every book on horses if possible, but you put me with a horse, I'm not going to know what the fuck to do. I don't want to die.
Yeah, like, we can all be like Jared Kushner and read one book on it and become an expert, right?
Yeah, but we don't live in an era where other people know how to break that horse down from matter into energy despite the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and send it kilometers away and then reassemble it in its original form.
All right. So anyway,
I don't think we're going to there's no consensus on this point.
But did you have other thoughts on the character of Jillian or
She's almost a plot device character more than anything else, and not so much that she even kind of has. There's a relationship. You can see obviously they're trying to push the kind of the Kirk and her relationship going. Like, I know you like the way that it's kind of like when you get to the later James Bond films where like the woman just goes, "No, what do you mean? Yeah, you're James Bond, but I don't give a crap, and I'm off." That's the same. This is the same kind of thing. Rather than having everyone fall into Kirk's arms, it's like, oh, no, I've got stuff to do. I actually can go off and do something. Yeah. And I like that, so that's pretty cool.
Fair enough. I see that. By the way, Jacob Blackman has joined us. Jacob, hey. Jacob's a longtime artist that's worked with Mike Lafferty on a lot of Fainting Goat products. And did Jacob illustrate your project, Chris? Your superhero stuff?
Do you mean the Summit?
The Summit, that was it. Yeah.
Storm Cook did that actually, but I'm hoping to get Jacob involved in future Ghost Show Press projects.
All right, I'm right on. All right, so what else have we not touched on? So,
I'm going to mention something. This is just a minor thing because every single movie thing we've done is I've always mentioned the costumes. Okay, so obviously because we're in the modern day era, you can get away with costumes. Costumes aren't too bad. The futuristic costumes they give the crew are pretty good as well. They're not kind of got into that kind of like, hey, make everything silver and shiny because they look like aliens. That's futuristic, and they look more. They even like the stuff that like McCoy wears. The jacket seems to be more realistic as a jacket rather than future jacket.
Yep.
But I will say, silly Vulcan headdresses right at the beginning. Oh my God, what the hell's that? They look like Smurfs. What is going on?
If A does not bring up the Vulcan technicians, I'm
going. Oh, this is like why. Why have they done that?
They've got like this sort of shark head, shark fin kind of hat that sticks up on top, and it's orange. Like they look like garden gnomes.
And you can understand it for like ceremonial headdresses for like, you know, the officials. But the idea these guys are walking around and kind of like building spaceships while wearing that is so bizarre.
But I love like that's led me to Vulcans, and that led me to Sarek. That scene at the end of the picture when Sarek almost admits he was wrong to Spock. He says, I never really approved of your mission to join Starfleet. That decision might have been in error, might have been a mistake. He doesn't say it was a mistake. He says it might have been a mistake, you know? And he doesn't say, I'm proud of you. he says, "I was very impressed by you." Right? It's I loved that conversation between Kirk and his father at that moment.
Okay, Jason, out of the box question for you.
Yeah.
Very reminiscent of a scene in Discovery season 2.
Okay. Now I have to, this is where you're gonna ask me about an episode I haven't watched yet, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, there's basically a very, very similar scene between Sarek and Spock.
Yeah.
And I assumed you'd seen it, but I was just going to ask, you know, how does that scene play now that an official Star Trek canon, they've already basically had this same conversation 20 years earlier.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was really struck by Discovery, I remember that earlier episode, I think it might even be first season, where it's revealed that Sarek's having like a heart flutter or something. And he does like this weird thing where he calls Burnham's mind across the galaxy or whatever.
Yeah.
And they do this bit where we find out that Burnham was applying to the Vulcan Science Academy and should have been allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
Sarek asked the Academy to reject her so he can save his family spot for his son. And then the beautiful irony of this, of course, is that then Spock grows up and refuses to go. So it's like the universe telling Sarek, up yours. And I love that. But that is also a retcon of this scene with Spock.
And how many times have we previously seen stuff with Sarek disapproving Spock's entry to Starfleet? Is it literally one episode in the original series? Is it?
It's Incident at Bay.
That's it. That is the only time. Yeah. So it's not. So again, we're seeing movies that again are literally pulling threads of stories from 30 years ago. And you have to be a Trek fan to kind of go, what the hell's he on about? So it's nice that they do that. If you're gonna write a new Trek story, respect the source material. So
you're right. They're playing for the 30-year-old fans, but at the same time, that conversation is every father and every son. Like I had that conversation with my dad, right? Where he was like, you know, maybe you did okay in this thing that I thought you wouldn't be able to do. I'm not saying that you did, but you might have. You son of a bitch.
I'm gonna talk to Chris's point.
Yeah.
I also had that conversation with my dad.
Yes.
In my entire life, I've had that conversation with him once.
Yes.
And I'll probably have it again when he's closer to his end.
Yes.
Like I imagine that's going to be a repeat conversation that we have. You know, when his health really starts failing.
Yeah.
To Chris's point, the scene in Discovery, I think, weakens the moment with Nimoy here in retrospect. Because it's you're right, that scene does happen. Well, Sarek basically says, "I'm proud of you," or it's the "I'm proud of you" conversation.
Yeah.
And it sort of lessens the impact of the journey that Nimoy still has to go on. Like Nimoy Spock still has to go on that, but now Peck Spock doesn't have to do that.
Peck's gotten that moment where his father says, "I'm proud of you." Yeah.
And it's just kind of weird because this moment, this conflict between the two of them is going to resurface a little bit in the episode Sarek and Next Generation.
Right. Yes.
With Picard's mind meld, but then also in Unification in Sarek's last episode.
Yep.
Like he's calling for Spock on his deathbed.
Right. Right.
Okay, just to mess with your mind a little bit, I believe it was last episode we talked about the idea that because we had the ball traveling back in time, then Cochrane knew of the future stuff. Maybe
this is Jim's theory that first contact changes history.
Yes, so
Enterprise
Discovery's mention and "I'm proud of you" speech is the only time he says it. He doesn't say it the other time, and that's all because he said it once before. He doesn't say it in the new timeline.
So there, you go,
there you go.
I love it.
Anybody else? I do think it's sort of like that's the problem that Star Trek Strange New Worlds is going to have. Like getting back to our announcement news, is you're dealing with Spock, and Spock is one of those tentpole characters that everyone has watched. Like he's one of the reasons why Star Trek wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Spock.
Yeah.
Like you can have like Cook as a template, like action hero captain on a starship. You have that in, like, you can have that in Lost in Space. You can put that in Forbidden Planet. There's nothing inherently remarkable about Cook as a character on paper, but Spock is engaging. Spock is what elevates Trek. So when you do a show where you're doing a whole TV show that's now based on the young adventure, the new adventures of young Spock, it's kind of like going back and doing a Batman story that has to do with his origin story. Like, how many things can you put a post-it note on?
Yeah.
On that 1 5-minute moment of his life. And like, it doesn't lose any context.
Yeah, like the Gotham television show, right? Where they end up rewriting that. So I have a question for you, speaking of Strange New Worlds. Am I recalling right that McCoy was an addition to the cast? He's not.
He was actually their third choice for Doctor. In the Cage, you have the legendary character actor John Hoyt as Dr. Philip Boyce.
Okay,
and one of my little unspoken wishes for the show is they'll bring him back.
Yeah,
because if you want to talk about character archetypes, they haven't done in a while. Really old guy in space.
That was actually my question. Was, are we going to get that Doctor back on the Enterprise?
I really hope so. I really do. I would love it if they brought back Jose Tyler and Colt and Garrison and all these other one-shot characters. Because what little bit we get to see of them, there's a lot of potential there. And honestly, the chemistry between Hoyt and Jeffrey Pike in that one extended scene that they have together, I would like to see more of that relationship.
Jim, you mentioned on Twitter there was a particular character from the series that you wanted to bring back.
Okay, I definitely want Holman Colt back. Okay. I think, like, just in terms of like making it like, yes, she's young. Yes, she's a redhead. Yes, she could be like a Tilly analog.
Sure.
But someone who actually has to bring the captain his coffee.
Yeah.
And has to function. Like, I want to explore that aspect of Trek. Well, my thing is, if you do Boyce, I want Gary Sinise in that role.
Oh, you'll never.
I want them to bring up a truckload of money and just bring it to Gary Sinise and be like, hey, we want you to do like 5 scenes.
Just put the truck in reverse and just empty the wagon onto it with cash, huh? All right.
That's the cool thing about this stuff, though.
I think the problem with taking the Cage's cast as it is, like if we took it whole cloth and you did one-to-one analogs, it's not going to work because that cast is very white.
Right.
Jose Tyler is not completely white.
No, Jose Tyler is not. But that's sort of my issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's openings elsewhere. I mean, there in Where No Man Has Gone Before, there's an African American male communications officer played by Lloyd Haynes, whose character name escapes me. So, why not play with the timeline a little bit and say he's also the communications officer under Pike.
Yeah.
This is what I was going to say. Yeah, the idea you've got literally the small amount of bridge crew we saw in the original pilot. You have got that idea. You can expand further afield, and we didn't see any alien races on the Enterprise. We didn't see anything, and obviously in Discovery we do.
Yeah,
we see lots.
Yeah, they make reference to a chief engineer that we never see on Discovery, and I can't remember the name, but as I recall, it's something fairly exotic. It could be a more representative character, or it could just be a straight up alien.
You know, and the concern about having a character on the show like Colt, who's too much like Tilly is so unique and distinctive. Like, the fact that she's a redhead is like the least important part of that character, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't think we have anything to worry about that. But
the thing I liked about Colt is
a visual medium, though.
Like, yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
So if those are young, idealistic. Don't like that's the reason why I can see Colt not being it. And also, this show is 3-4 years removed from the Cage. Like, this is his second 5-year mission.
Yeah.
Right? In terms of like how the Star Trek timeline breaks out.
I think so.
So you can easily say that, you know, characters like Tyler and Colt transferred out. But I do want to see the Doctor. I think that's like Boyce is so important. In terms of the like structure of that episode, I've stolen the name and used it for the old character in like other stories because it was so evocative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everything about that little role where he makes the Maltini.
All right, guys. Well, listen, we have over an hour. We should let our audience go. Anything that we have missed that we need to know about Star Trek IV before we move on?
Well, the other thing that I love about this film very briefly that we get a chance to touch upon is it's a great example of how to do politics in media, because it has an important political message, but it's done in an engaging, dramatic, entertaining fashion that, I mean, it realizes it has to be good entertainment or the message will be lost. And if any film that political, that's not just the writer standing on my chest and screaming in my face, you know, that I have to salute. And really, that may be the aspect of the film that's aged the best. It's a political film that doesn't feel like one.
It's very hard to disagree with the point of this movie. Right? Like, are you going to say, no, let's not save the whales? What are you, some kind of
if Kirk needed volunteers for that mission, he would have Rush Limbaugh and Rachel Maddow both on that ship.
Right, right.
And again, the cool thing about having time travel stories that go back into the past is they don't age, because it's like, hey, it's the 90s, it's the 90s. It's like, yeah, that's where they traveled to time. So it doesn't even like look 70s, 80s. Yes, of course it looks 70s, 80s, because that's when it was set. So
now it's a period picture.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna use a little bit of trivia for my last note.
Sure.
So Colt Thatchell is an associate producer on this movie. He plays Punk Rockwell on the bus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So not only that, but he also has a boombox in Spider-Man Homecoming. And
yes.
Colt Thatchell with the boombox, and Spider-Man looks down from him like he's sitting in the windowsill or something like that.
Yes.
And it's like two people in the street. And the old heavyset man is Colt Thatchell. Calling back to the punk rock days of Star Trek IV. And I love that.
You know, I would love to be able to make movies and put myself in all of them in these sort of bizarre cameo roles. After Star Trek IV, we get Star Trek V. Now, for those of you that have been tuning in for a while, you know that one of our very earliest episodes, it became clear that Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, is Jim's favorite Star Trek movie. This film, which is widely regarded as an absolute raging garbage fire by other people. So we're going to give Jim a chance to make his case for Star Trek V.
I'm going to convolt all of you. All of you will be convolted by the time I am done talking.
There you go. We're going to give Jim a soapbox. But set us up a little bit. Like, my impression is that Star Trek V is the film that William Shatner makes, that Nimoy gets to direct this one, or write this one, direct it rather. And in exchange, it's now Shatner's turn to direct a movie. And I have heard so many budget stories about how this film gets chopped and cut but for those of us that have not rewatched it in a long time, and we're gonna rewatch it for the show, what should we be looking for? How can help me enjoy this movie?
Okay, all right. So those different criteria, we look at franchise movies, right?
Yep.
So we look at movies as whether or not it's a good movie. Star Trek V is inherently not a good movie.
Okay.
Star Trek V is a good Star Trek movie.
Okay.
In terms of, it represents the best and the worst that original series Trek has to offer.
Okay.
So follow along with the characters and keep in mind that, like, Star Trek isn't just City on the Edge of Forever. Star Trek isn't the Doomsday Machine. Star Trek is also the Cloud Miners. Star Trek is also Spock's brain. Star Trek is also This Way to Eden. Like, there's some bad episodes in there, but they're all made with intent.
Right.
And I think that's the intent of Star Trek V is inherently a positive one, because it is trying to comment on something that's happening in the world of the 1989, of the late 80s. And I think that's sort of what gets lost in the fact of it's not a good movie.
Right, right. We lose its historical context, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And also this idea that you're suggesting that it's kind of the apotheosis of everything both good and bad about Star Trek at the same time.
It's the only movie where Captain Kirk acts like Captain Kirk.
Okay.
Like, he called Captain Kirk.
All right, you'll get to explain that when we come back.
You'll expound on that.
All right.
I waited years to have this conversation.
Well, we're going to give it to you. We're going to give you the open mic. All right. Chris, can you join us again next week?
I'd be very, very, very honored.
Wonderful. All right. Abe, we're going to wake you up again at 10.
Yeah, so good.
And thanks, everybody, for watching. And to Mike and Jacob for coming by. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.